Tonight's lecture is to be the lecture on Pesach. And knowing that Pesach is was shortly coming, I began writing about, of course no one can ask me why I began writing on that subject, but then I realized why. On beliefs and miracles. On beliefs and miracles. And I realized that those are the two words that have been totally corrupted in the past 2,000 years. Totally corrupted. And what you're going to hear tonight will be a preview of a new book. But I realized that since 1971, when we opened the doors to everyone, whoever seeks Kabbalah can walk in and learn, of which we were severely criticized, even to this very date, even to the extent of locking people up in jail. False testimony, because their only crime that they have committed is they want to disseminate the language and the secrets of Kabbalah, which should be revealed today, according to all sages of a prior generation and backwards. Only it's those of today that are still adamant in their decision to betray their Jewish people and permit all of us to remain with our problems forever. The precept that the Jew was given prior to the 10th plague, which is the slaying of the firstborn, prior to that 10th plague, which then, that evening, brought the freedom that Jews supposedly had been waiting for 210 years to be released from their bondage in Egypt. While they had been given other precepts, in fact, the first precept that was given to the Jews before Mount Sinai, and this is what, unfortunately, for 2,000 years had not been known, including yours truly, didn't know, although I have been studying all my life. But until I entered the world of Kabbalah, I guess it was very important that this precept be kept a secret. And it was kept a secret from me, as it is from the few million Jews that are still left in this world. The first precept the Jews received prior to this precept, which seems so insignificant, and it is insignificant for, I would say, 99% of the Jews, meaning those who are, or maybe 95, whatever those percentages who do not learn Kabbalah, this precept also is just one of those that really don't have to be adhered to. And the first one, before there was a Mount Sinai, the first precept in Egypt was, V'yadat et Hashem. You must know your God. Nowhere did this first precept mention anything about believing in God. In fact, there is no such thing as believing in God. Now, we all know that people are asked, do you believe in God? Most of the people believe in one way or another, one religion or another, in the fact that there is a God. However, that precept did not say believe in God. The first precept was to know God. Now, how do you know something you've never met, you've never seen, you've never heard? Outside of one time on Mount Sinai, they heard the voice of God. They heard the voice of God, never saw God. In fact, Moses, who pleaded with God to permit him to see God, said, only those who see me shall perish. And therefore, No one can see my face while he exists in this corporeal body. So we're asked to believe in someone. In fact, the word belief, as you have heard many times in the classes, means I'm not sure. I believe. You don't say I know. I believe it is so, indicating that you are not 100% sure. But you believe that way. You have an opinion. I believe this way. It could be another way, but I believe this way. Therefore, the first precept was to know God. And says the Zohar right there in discussing this first precept in Egypt, to know God means to connect with God. We will never know who God is. In fact, even if we connect with God, the only way we will know if there is God or not is like it says in Malachi, that when you have the blessing of God, you will know there is a God. That becomes a little difficult, and I can understand if I was a rabbi in a Bet HaKnesset, and I would tell all my congregants, listen, the only time believe in God when you see things turned around and things got better. Well, if we just look at 2,000 years of Jewish history, we kind of see the reverse. That means the rabbi would almost be saying to his congregant, listen, I'm not going to fool you, neither am I going to fool myself. I know how much trouble I have in my own life, and here I'm going to try to tell you that the only way that you can begin to know if God is there, if things really go well for you. If you have no uncertainty in your life, if you're not sure about tomorrow, then of course you live in anxiety. That's not a connection with God. Then there would really be very few people attending a synagogue today. To go to a synagogue knowing that if he makes what we call the connections and he walks out and looks, is there a blessing or not? That's the only way, says the prophet Malachi, will we know if there is bracha, then we will know. All the teachings in the world, all the explanations in the world will never convince you of knowing God. Oh, it could put you into belief. Well, sometimes I notice he is there. In fact, sometimes I have miracles happening in my life. So I know that it must have been God because it was a supernatural thing that occurred to me that permitted me to continue living when, by all reasons and normalcy, in this accident, that person shouldn't have survived. So obviously, there is a supernatural paranormal force in the world. So who is it? It must be God. That was the first precept. You must know God. And therefore, Rabbi Shimon makes it very clear that if you do not connect, because knowing means connection, like when we say Adam knew Eve and she became pregnant. It does not, and she gave birth. It doesn't even say she became pregnant. She became birth just by Adam knowing Eve. That's a great miracle. Well, nobody believes that. And we do not have to believe it because it's not true. Then how did she get pregnant? So the Zohar says, the indication here, just by knowing, meant knowing is connection. They had intercourse. But no, intercourse means when there is direct contact. Speaking about God, when we speak about God, it means we have connected with God. We have made a connection. The knowing aspect is connection. Therefore, we must make our connections before we can know God. Then we have the second precept, which says Achodesh in chapter 12, verse 2, and it says, this month, the month of Nisan, this month that we're approaching on Shabbat, this month is known as Rosh Chodeshim Rishon Hu Lachem, L'Chodshei HaShanah. This month shall be considered the first month of the year for all of the other 12 months. And I'm sure many of you already have read Star Connection, the corruption of Jews for 2,000 years and thinking Rosh Hashanah was the new year. When it says, without a question, this is HaKodesh Zeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim Rishonu Lachem. It is the first month of the year. The first month of the year. If you haven't, I'm sure everyone here had already heard that expression of the Zohar. And in fact, to put a little more fire... A little more flame, on the fire, you know that Rosh Hashanah is the seventh month of the year, not the first. So if there is anyone who ever mentions that Rosh Hashanah is the new year, then you know it's the seventh month. And it clearly says so in Parshat Pinchas that Rosh Hashanah is the seventh month of the year. And I'm not here tonight to clarify that because it has been already clarified on tapes and so on. Because that's not the purpose of this evening's lecture. However, this is the first month. This is the top of the month. This is the seed of the month for all year. The seed. Seed for what? Seed for what? Seed for what? But it does say clearly, this is the first month and is the head, meaning Rosh, which means the seed where all thoughts are formulated, where all thoughts originate, where from these origins comes future manifestations. This is the month. Now, if you think you're ever going to do anything with your life, you'd better do it this month. And so while on tapes and the books that are written and marathons that we provide, all of these are going to give you the tools. But if you do not understand, if you do not understand where your consciousness must also be at the same time, then I'm sorry to say, with all of the wonderful and really enlightening tools that we provide about the Seder, and as you all know, the idea of a family gathering on Pesach had so destroyed any opportunity for Jews to move out of the clutches of anti-Semites, as this expression goes, or other problems that Jews particularly suffer. This is your month. This is your month. There is no other month. Yes, the rest of the year, it's like medical research. If you change things within the fetus, it's a lot easier. But then once whatever had been contained within the fetus ultimately develops and becomes manifest, it becomes a little more difficult at that time. So we're operating on a seed level here, and that's where we can really make changes. During the year, it's with difficulty, extreme difficulty, that we can alter and change the cassette that is established this month. And that's why, by and within itself, Passover is a very important holiday. Very important holiday. Briefly, just not to leave you hanging in the dark, concerning Rosh Hashanah, all that does is whether you're going to live or not live for the next 12 months. But how that life is formulated is going to take place and going to be executed during this month. And I'll explain just exactly what I mean by that. But that's the difference between Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is just an opportunity for us to be certain that even though the cards are stacked against us because of all our negative activity that we had placed within ourselves and within the cosmos the past year, we can alter that cassette, and therefore, where we should have not received life for one more year, we can alter that and receive life for another year. But how that life becomes manifested, that we can be a prisoner in our own home, we can have fear throughout the year, justifiable fear, in fact, cannot be altered on Rosh Hashanah. Cannot be altered on Rosh Hashanah. This is the time that it will and can be altered. This is the significance of this month. It is the seed of the entire year. Now, what is this month about? What is it about? This month, of course, contains Passover. As you already know from the tapes, and Kabbalah connection, the Jews were extremely unhappy to have ever left Egypt. That theme weaves itself right through the Torah, always complaining to Moses, why did you take us out of such a wonderful land? Why did you take us to the wilderness where you thought maybe there weren't enough graves in Egypt for us to be buried? So you brought us here so we'd have more cemetery space, like here in the metropolitan area. There's a lack of cemetery place. So you thought you took us out for that reason. No time did they ever forget the wonderful food and restaurants that existed in Egypt, and constantly complaining, when do we go back? So that myth and corruption about Passover, the Jews received their freedom. What freedom? From bondage, from slavery. Make no mistake, the Torah tells you, right through Exodus, right through Numbers, constantly complaining with a desire to return. So what is this month? What is the freedom? What is that freedom? What that freedom is, I shall explain this evening. How to connect with that force and power called freedom is Pesach, Passover. There you will have to resort to the tapes and whatever other information we provide you as how to connect. And I can tell you, if you're only connecting with a family dinner, I'm not asking you not to enjoy yourself, but do not at least enter with the innocence that you have accomplished anything. In fact, if there is no one there who is in-tuned into the consciousness of what Passover is about, you've lost a wonderful opportunity, and never go back to God and say, God, why do bad things happen to good people? You shall shortly learn how that's the expression that tonight we will do away with. Just a side thought, that I realize that if just the last few months that I have been concentrating in this area, I said it's almost like it was the cart leading the horse. Because I realized after 20 years, and even those who have studied here in the mornings, which is very extensive, which is here about 7 years, and in Israel since 1976, where there were extensive studies by me personally conducting these various courses, I realized that very few got the message. They got the tools, but didn't know what to do with the tools. They had all the information, how to use the tools, but they didn't understand that they were to be a participant. They thought if you just prayed the words, or if you do everything we say must be done on Passover, and it's very extensive, if you do not conduct yourself on Passover with the Seder of the Zohar, the Seder of the Ari, at least don't be burdensome on anybody or yourself. Skip the Seder, enjoy your family meal, and go home. But don't read the Agada just for the sake of reading it and not understanding why, what for, and don't eat the matzah. You can wash your hands if you wash your hands and go home. Maybe enjoy a good turkey or a good meatloaf or whatever is prepared, but you're wasting your time and being led falsely into the conviction that I've done something this evening. I come to the splitting of the Red Sea. Splitting of the Red Sea took place also in the month of Nisan. In fact, 7 days later, exactly 7 days later, splitting of the Red Sea. Needless to say, in chapter 14, as they are standing at the Red Sea, there are the Egyptians in back, the sea in front of them. And naturally, the Jews are in a dilemma. It would have been better had they remained in Egypt. Now they surely will suffer death. They will surely suffer death, either at the hands of the Egyptians or drown in the sea. And God says, Ma titzak alai, why are you crying and yelling to me? Tell the Jews, Sa, travel into the water. Well, I don't know who else we should cry in time of need than to God. But God says, why are you yelling to me? Well, who else should the Jews have yelled to if not God, pleading with God to save them? What is this expression all about? And then what does it say? in verse 16 of chapter 14. Lift up your wand, your rod, the same rod that turned into a snake and backwards. Unetayet yadcha, then bend your hand over on the sea. Ufkaehu, and split it. And the Jews shall enter into the sea by Yabasha, and the waters and the earth will be dry. The earth will be dry. That's what he's telling Moses to do. And then in verse 21, five verses later, it says, Vayet Moshe et yado al hayam, and he lifted up his hand on the sea. Doesn't say he lifted up, because remember what God said? Harem et matcha, raise up your wand, your rod, and then stretch your hand over the sea. Here it says, in just five verses later, and Moses bent his hand on the sea, and then came a ruach kadim azah, a very strong east wind, and it vayasem etayam lecharava vayiboku hamayim, and it, the wind turned the waters to be dried where they can walk through. Vayiboku hamayim, and then he split the waters. Have you ever read the Bible? Have you ever noticed that before? That's really a miracle. Can you imagine? He didn't even listen to God, maybe. Because God said, lift up your hand. It doesn't say that he did that. It says he bent his hand. You know, there's a difference between lifting up your hand, meaning lifting up the wand, and bending his hand. What about the wand? And then came an east wind. Now, who did the miracle? Was it Moshe's wand? Moshe's arm? The east wind? Who provided the miracle here? From the verse, in verse 21, it appears, for all intents and purposes, that it was the wind. And therefore, there are so many commentaries on this verse that maybe it was low tide and it was at a place of the Red Sea where the water was very shallow, and so all you needed was just a little wind to blow, and therefore they walked across. That's not such a miracle. That's not such a miracle. And then it says, Vayiboku hamayim, and then the water split. You mean they walked in first over the dry land, and then the water split? Makes absolutely no sense. Makes absolutely no sense. Okay? To return to the first precept, second precept, I'm sorry, about the new moon, informing us that this month is the seed of the month. From this precept, what is the precept? Just to know? No. The precept is to do what the three stages that we do, that we have learned by virtue of the sages, etc., that this idea of new month requires that the Shabbat before the new month of Nisan, you come to the synagogue. I hope it's only a place like the center, because in that you could have stayed home. And I mean that sincerely, because I have quoted before the Zohar, and I will again quote it this evening, but I don't quote it that often because I feel it might rub people the wrong way when you tell them the truth. So I don't mention it that often. But in any event, when you come and you do a certain prayer called Mevarchim Achodesh, which must be done before, and that has been already explained elsewhere, look at how many other ideas you may be missing, and then you concentrate on the two letters of the next month, which is not the Kuf and Gimel, but rather the Dalet and the Hay. This is the concentration because you're tuning in to these two letters, which shall bring you control of the month. One stage. Second stage is Rosh Chodesh. Actually, on the day of Rosh Chodesh, we again do a certain prayer and meditation. And without the meditation, I can also assure you, Rosh Chodesh is a very long prayer. If you're not into long prayers, then here's an opportunity to stay home. Because if you don't know why you're coming, you might as well stay home. Silly to just come and spend an hour and a half or 2 hours and walk home empty like the Zohar says. I'm saying that very clearly so nobody can take it out of context. I said the Zohar says you could have stayed home because you're walking out empty. And then comes the third stage, which is the Kiddush HaChodesh. That means after 7 days, we begin a special prayer outside called Kiddush HaChodesh. Some say you sanctify the moon. I thought the moon already was created without our participation. Do we have to really sanctify the moon? Well, God said so. But of course, that itself is a corruption. Kiddush does not mean sanctify. Kiddush does not mean holy. These are all corrupted words. Kiddush means circle, circuitry. That's what Kiddush means. Make a circuitry, whatever that means. But this has to do with that one particular feature of what is stated in chapter 14, chapter 12, just to repeat it again, verse 2. Kiddush HaChodesh. Kiddush HaChodesh. That must be done equally as well as we have already learned, and everyone here, I'm sure, understands and appreciates the idea that what we are doing with these three aspects concerning the new month is to take control of the new month. That the new month does not govern us as robotic consciousness, but rather we, through our connection and through a circuitry with the moon, can establish our rulership over the moon rather than, as was established in the beginning of creation, that the moon would rule at night. This is the aspect of the Red Sea. These will be three highlights. And now we come to another very important section, also in Bishalach, and also in Exodus, chapter 17. When suddenly, and it wasn't suddenly, Amalek comes, and you all know what that means. Amalek, the enemy of Israel. The enemy of Israel. Incidentally, it doesn't happen to be non-Jews. And you know who they were. I think you heard, if whoever came on Shabbat heard who Amalek was. It was the Jew to himself. His worst own enemy. And he came to do battle with the Jews. And Moshe tells Joshua, choose people to be part of your army. Not to ask for volunteers. No volunteers. You choose them. And already it is explained by most of the commentators on the spot. Choose those who you know I mean for you to choose. And go out and fight with Amalek. And I will stand on top of this little mount. And the rod in my hand. And it says when Moses' hand was raised up, the Jews were winning. When Moses' hands went down, Amalek was winning. And when Moses' hands became very heavy, so he asked Aaron and Hur, Aaron on one side, the right side, and Hur on the other side, keep my hands up. Vahi yadav emuna. I said it's never mentioned in terms of belief. Vahi yadav emuna ad bo hashemesh. And his hands, let's say we'll use the word belief, since you're all familiar with the word emuna meaning belief, and his hands believed. Obviously, Moshe didn't believe. And his hands believed. And then Joshua when his hands went up again with the support of Aaron and Hur on either side. Could you tell me why would Moses ever want to lower his hands? What do you mean up and down? What is he? And this is the seesaw puzzle, you know, the seesaw back and forth. When he raises his hands, the Jews win. When he lowers his hands, Amalek wins. Didn't he have any pity on the Jews? Keep them raised all the time. What is this game? Why does the Torah have to tell us that when his hands went down, did Moshe know when his hands went down, what would be the consequence? Of course he did. Then why do you lower it? Obviously, this is a chapter stated both in the Zohar, that if you read it superficially, as I have just translated, you know absolutely nothing of what the verse is trying to teach us. With this in mind, we now go to the essential meaning of this night's lecture. I have found that one can have acquired all of the knowledge of Kabbalah, but if there's one ingredient missing, then all of the knowledge is to, I won't say no avail, but certainly will never accomplish miracles at our desire. Now, can miracles be accomplished when we so desire? What are miracles? Miracles are what? They happen infrequently. If they happened every day, would you call it a miracle? Of course not. A miracle means when something happens to me. When? Good or bad? Do you call that a miracle too? Or is a miracle only when it's good? You mean when something is bad, supernatural, paranormal? A ship capsizes. And it shouldn't have. It was built perfectly well. Do we say a miracle happened and all the people perished? So a miracle obviously happens to have one definition. What? When good things happen, and they shouldn't maybe have happened, then we call them miracles. Then God had listened to us, injected his own supernatural powers, and created the miracle. And of course, the Hebrew word for miracle, we have said already many, many times in the past, is such a corruption. Nes is the Hebrew word for miracle. Nes. Ask any Israeli. Tell him what's the word for miracle. He'll say nes. And yet, if you look right through the Torah, you'll always see that the word for nes means, like Vayanusu, they fled. They fled? Who fled? How does miracle come to fleeing? What a corruption. And to this very moment, an Israeli or someone who speaks Jewish will say nes, or anyone who speaks Hebrew will say, oh, a nes happened. What does that have to do with fleeing? It's a little warm in here, I think. What? Yeah, I think so. I'm not that hot, but I can feel people are hot. What does miracle mean? Before I've embarked on the subject of beliefs and miracles, now we don't know what belief means anymore, and now we don't even know what miracles mean. And here I'm going to deliver you a lecture about the miracle of Passover. And I'm telling you in advance that what you considered, or I considered, until I entered the world of Kabbalah, the miracle of Passover, I find out they never even wanted to leave. Is that a miracle? When things go bad, that's a miracle? Therefore, we come to a Zohar in Parsha Truma. Parsha Truma. In this edition, I thought it was this page. thought it was here. But I have mentioned this Zohar many a time. I'm pretty sure it was here. Maybe Vayakel, no? Maybe Vayakel. But I'll mention the Zohar, but I wanted to read it. At the time of creation, it says that each day, with the creation of the first day, second day, until the seventh day, God made a stipulation, a tanai, a stipulation. Like when he created water the second day, he made a stipulation and said, water, your natural tendency is, yeah, okay, it's the same page, but different section. Okay. It says, this is when the Zohar is discussing in Parshat Vayakel, which is volume 10, in the Zohar, page 23, discussing the idea of Jonah and the whale, etc. It says that God made a condition with the fish, with this fish in particular. Hitna imahem, and he made a stipulation that when you have to, there will be a fish that must swallow up Jonah, keep him in his system for 3 days and 3 nights, and then thrust him out. He also made a stipulation when he created the heavens that when Elijah the prophet will ascend into space, as we know, no one can live in outer space unless they walk with a space suit. But Eliyahu went up into outer space because of the air, whatever other conditions. We know that no one can exist in outer space. And there was a stipulation that the environment of space should not devour Eliyahu, but that he could exist in outer space. Also made a condition with when he created the light. He said that there will come a time in Egypt that I want there to be 3 days of darkness and 3 days, 3 days of total darkness. And that would be, again, changing the original aspect of creation, that every 24 hours there be a part of day and a part of night. And suddenly in Egypt, there were 3 full days of night. And therefore, God made a stipulation at the time of creation. And on the fourth day, He made another condition at the time of creation, which he created, the third day, with the earth. That the earth must open up when the story of Korach, which I won't discuss now, happened, and that would be the condition because the earth should not open up. It was not created to be open, but there was a stipulation that at times There will be a change in the structure of Earth and so on. And for every day, it goes on. For every day. And he says, also, at the time he made water, he also made a stipulation that the water, while its tendency is to flow, when the Jews were to leave Egypt and cross the Red Sea, there's a stipulation that the sea would cease to flow and not continue with its normal tendency of flowing. Therefore, the idea of the splitting of the Red Sea, had there been no stipulation at the time of creation, says the Zohar, no one could have split that Red Sea, including God. I mean, the question is the same way God made the stipulation and told the water, listen, your tendency is to flow. And I'm telling you, there's one stipulation here. I'm making a condition on your creation, within your creation. Why couldn't God, the Almighty, make that stipulation the night that the Jews were ready to cross the Red Sea? I mean, God is powerless. There's someone that can hold God back from commanding the waters. From commanding the waters to split. Why didn't God do the miracle? Who did the miracle? If not God, a supernatural thing. It's supernatural. Who did the miracle? Well, we all think that miracles can only be through God. But yet, there's a whole little scene here with God telling Moses, wave up your wand, your rod, bend your hand. Then came an east wind. Where's God? Yes, God did bring the east wind. See, that he did. He goes through this whole procedure. And nowhere does it say that God created the miracle. But it's a supernatural event. Isn't it God? Isn't it God? In a discussion of miracles, contrary to accepted concepts and understandings of miracles, contrary, the Zohar, not I, the Zohar has an entirely different explanation. An entirely different explanation. That's why I say we have the tools on Passover. We have the tools what to do on Rosh Chodesh and Kiddush HaChodesh with the letters. But all along, there was lacking another consciousness, which, according to the Zohar, miracles is a myth. The word miracle is a myth. In fact, the miracle is when bad things happen. But that's happening all the time. The miracles are the ones that happen so infrequent. So I'd like to read a Zohar. In Parshat Balak. A Zohar. I would not even want to read this orally. Because orally, maybe I put in my own interpretation. Orally, maybe it doesn't even exist. I gave you the wrong page, I might say. It happens. Although our chief editor, Roy, always goes over the references and does find sometimes that there are, unfortunately, mistakes in the references, meaning the printer or we put down the wrong page of the reference. Anyway, here's a story about Rabbi Pinchas. And the heading of the chapter by Rabbi Ashlag is Lo Osen Niflaot Gedolot Levado. He himself does great miracles, and that's the caption. But anyway, here it says, Rabbi Pinchas was haya olech lirot bito eshet Rabbi Shimon, shehaita chola. Rabbi Pinchas was going to visit his daughter, who of course be worldwide known, although we never found out her name. She is the daughter, his daughter was the wife of Rabbi Shimon. And he went to visit his daughter. Doesn't say his daughter's name. It just says, it doesn't even say he just went to visit his daughter, but it says, just remember that his daughter is the wife, I guess he was a chauvinist, and it mentions the wife of Rabbi Shimon. And he was going on his donkey. And I'm sure most of you, or many of you, are familiar with Rabbi Pinchas' donkey. There was another very famous donkey, the donkey of Bilam, which we will also refer to this evening. That is truly a miracle, because just in advance, I'm going to tell you that these donkeys could speak. Now, that's a miracle. That's absolutely a miracle. Can you tell me why it's a miracle? Why is it a miracle? Why is it a miracle? Because we have never seen donkeys speak. So you know how we measure miracles then. How do we measure miracles? Well, let's say someone has gone through a life without any mishap, without any misfortune, if such as is possible. Such as possible. Rabbi Shimon said he did. But we're not Rabbi Shimon. Would we call that a miracle for him? Or we would say, this man has lived a miraculous life. Would he consider it a miracle? No, he's living a normal life. What's not happening? Oh, you mean he didn't have $11 billion and lost it overnight? Which, that's really a miracle. I don't even consider the miracle of making $11 billion to be a miracle. I consider a miracle, remember what we said about stipulations? God created stipulations. I consider it a miracle how you lose $11 billion in 2 years. Oh, you mean it's an unfortunate or a misfortunate event that happens to an individual? But isn't that miraculous? Oh, miracles really mean only when something happens good that shouldn't have happened. Oh, you mean losing money shouldn't happen? Nobody loses money in the world. The point I'm making is tonight, I feel this is so important that tonight and every center in the world is going to have this tape, because our whole idea of miracles is so corrupt. Whatever is bad can't be attributed to a miracle, because the preacher, the rabbi, or the Sufi in Islam, they all tell you what? A miracle is when things should have happened and some supernatural power called God came and changed it. And what was the supernatural power of losing $11 billion in 2 years? That's not a supernatural power. Some of us have $50 and we may keep the same $50 throughout the year if it's a little extra money. We don't lose it necessarily. How do you lose $11 billion in 2 years? That's not a miracle. My friends, that's wrong. That's not the interpretation of miracle. There's got to be another explanation, because it's such a farce if we begin to penetrate into this word called miracle or beliefs. And he's traveling to see his daughter. And he's going along the way, Pokshu Bebet Aravim, and he met two Arabs. Sha'alotam, they must have had good relations at that time. Sha'alotam, he asks them, Im besadeh zeh nitoreh pam kol mimei ha'olam. If you remember, in this spot, right where I'm standing, if there were ever was aroused a voice coming from somewhere, and they answered, Mimei olam einanu yodim. We don't know if voices still travel from before to the present. Binyamim shalanu, but from, let's say, our days recently, anu yodim ki yom echad, one day shodidim hayu poshtim al dake anashim basadeh ahu, that there was always robbers congregating in this place. I guess they must have had a convention. Or we might say maybe it was a pass, you know, it would be easy. But there was no, it was just a plain field. And they all congregated in this spot. In this spot. Upogu b'Yehudim. And coming along the way was Jews. Ubo la'bed otam, they wanted to eliminate them. See, you think it's a, I just thought about it. You think the expression of rubbing out somebody is a mafia expression. The Zoe uses it, so it's not, there's no copyright. Ubo la'bed, he wanted to eliminate them, rub them out. Okay. Mirachok basadehu. From a very far distance from this field was heard the voice of a donkey that you are riding on, because he was riding on a donkey. And it was braying. Shainor shtei pamim. It was braying. Uba shel hevet esh im kol ahu v'saraf otam. And because these two donkeys were yelling and screaming, came down a torch of fire and devoured them. With this voice came a fire and v'saraf otam. V'nislu el ha-yudim, and these two Jews were saved. Amalahem, said Rabbi Pinchas to the Arabs. Aravim, Aravim. Arabs, Arabs. Bizkut ze, davaze sha'amatem li, tiyu nisilim biyom hazeh mishodedim hamachakim lachem baderech. There are robbers along your way, along your path, but you shall be saved from them. He wished them well. And Rabbi Pinchas said like this. Mikra shel hanes hazeh asita bishvili. My donkey, when I was there somewhere, created a miracle, and I don't even know about it. And he goes on to say, that God does miracles every day with every person. But we don't know. We don't know. We don't know. Maybe someone's coming to kill him. Person has a heart attack or some other accident and he never shows up. And we may never even know. And he goes on, it's a lengthy Zohar, but he goes on to say that at the time of creation, the steps of this donkey, the steps were watched al pi Hashem. Where does it say al pi Hashem? Through God. And I turn now to the donkey of Bilam. When he began to beat, remember the donkey was pressing his feet against the wall. And the donkey saw God, and it's a story that is in chapter 22 of Numbers, Bamidbar. And he didn't want to go further, and he started beating him. Vayiftach Hashem et pi ha'aton. And God opened up the mouth of the donkey. And he spoke to him. Says the Zohar here in this Parshat Balak, in his lengthy discussion, that we can create, and we create, I should say, not we, well, we can, and we do create our own miracles. Well, all you have to do is create your miracle. So what's so difficult? Say, God, listen, I need a miracle now. I just lost $11 billion. Now give it back to me. That would be a nice miracle. Or someone who has, God forbid, a serious illness. God, take it away. Things of that nature don't happen. Therefore, miracles don't happen all the time. What the idea of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, and I will show it in other places too, as it is demonstrated in the splitting of the Red Sea, God does not make miracles. Because what is miracles? Miracles comes from the word fleeing. Fleeing. As we have discussed on many occasions, and more importantly, in the power of one, to the power of one, there are two levels of universes. There are parallel universes in this world, not up there. And Olam Haba is not somewhere where we can't see it. Meaning it must be all the ways out. And usually people think Olam Haba is when you die, then you earn the reward of Olam Haba, that you must first die before you can get Olam Haba. You hear that expression, as I heard it for 30 years. That's Olam Haba. After you die. God, can't you help me out a little and give me a little Olam Haba while I'm alive here? No? No? Because the interpretation of Olam Haba does not mean after death. You can have the Olam Haba right here. But there are two parallel universes. It's that simple, says the Zohar. One is called Etz HaChayim, the one he created in the Garden of Eden. Remember, for Adam, created one tree called the Etz HaChayim, and then he created another level of universe, said Olam, says the Zohar, Etz HaDat, the tree of knowledge. There it says good and evil. There it says good and evil. That's the world of good and evil. That's the world which we refer to, as the Zohar refers to, as the illusionary reality of our existence. That means that everything around us in a corporeal way is an illusion. That means when you see me here, you don't see me. It means when I see you out there, you're not there. Until, like the scientists say, and we have corroboration from the scientists, that until you see the chair doesn't exist. Until you see your friend doesn't exist. Until you see the table, it doesn't exist. When you see the table, when you see your friend, when you see the chair, that's when it exists. But like I said Tuesday morning, Einstein already had one problem with that conclusive theory. When he came home and he was absent-minded and he forgot his key in the classroom and he wanted to go into the house and he said to the door, "You're not there." And you know what happened? He couldn't get in. So he had a problem now. In class, he's teaching everyone that anything physical is not there. And when he got home. And another thing, if all you have to do to say something of a physical nature, this is established, what was established by Rabbi Shimon 2,000 years ago, that if someone has cancer, or why does he say cancer? Why doesn't the scientist bring him down and say, "Look, you believe that anything of a physical value is not there if I say it's not there?" He says, "Yes. So please do me a favor. This person has cancer. Remove it by saying it's not there." He has a problem. In theory, it's correct. But from a practical point of view, it's incorrect. They said. Because why is it incorrect? Because it doesn't work. We have these two levels. We have these two levels of reality. We have these two levels. One is called the Etz HaChayim. That Etz HaChayim level is where the light force exists. We could never bring God down here. Can't bring him down here. You can connect by taking a trip to the Etz HaChayim. That doesn't mean a physical trip. It means one kind of a trip. It's the trip that we take all the time. What trip is that? Consciousness. You feel you want to be in Israel, you want to see the things you saw in Israel. How long does it take you to travel there? A second. If a second. If you feel you need a vacation, but it's impossible to take one now, if you can travel back in 1 second to the place where you're relaxing on the beach, how long will it take you to travel there? Even though you can't get there? A second. Some people even consider consciousness the most important aspect of us. In other words, when I lift my hand, it wasn't the hand that really went up by itself, but maybe some unconscious thought move the hand up. Or maybe some of you believe that the hand moves up and down by itself. That's possible. And we're not here to disagree. But I think we might believe to an extent that maybe my mind directed the hand to move up and down. And the mind, as we know, scientists have no idea what that is. They also admit to that. Although, if you read To the Power of One, you found out what Rabbi Shimon says about the mind, without all of the billions and billions of dollars of research, which they still have not found out, of what the mind is about. The mind. There is only one feature that connects with the, that can connect with the Etz HaChaim all the time. But I must also have letters. I must also have a seder on Pesach. I must also have a sukkah to permit the physical reality to participate in the normal living reality of what we call good miracles, called the Etz HaChaim. We must have that consciousness, number one, that there is a place that does not know of misfortune. That's called the Etz HaChaim. I'm not here to tell you this evening that you must accept this principle. But I'm telling you, since I know that none of us all the time have dictated the rules in our life. None of us have always demanded and received every step and every moment of our life to turn out the way we decide. So there is no dispute. And maybe we ought to finally let go, surrender, that we must be like the light force of God called the Etz HaChaim, and to understand that we are not in our conscious mind in control, because if you do not surrender your conscious mind, well, does that mean I surrender and now I'm a slave? No. Remain a conscious slave. Remain a conscious slave with misfortune. Nobody tells you you must surrender that consciousness. That can only bring us at times, and during our life, must bring us misfortune. Must. Because the only place where there is misfortune is Etz HaDaat, the tree of knowledge reality, where we live. That's why it says good and evil. You know why it says good and evil? That's the little game that the Dark Lord or the Satan plays with us. If it would be all evil from the very moment of birth, then we would be seeking every moment what? Isn't there a good life around? If there was only a bad life all the time, 365 days of the year, day in and day out, would we look for another place? No. But we settle for less. How? All 365 years haven't been so terrible. Maybe only 363 have been terrible, but I remember 2 days of the year, it was good. And therefore, because I have those 2 days, which comes only from Satan, to give you a few good days, and you say, well, thank God things turned around. Oh, thank God I hear the economy is now going up. Oh, thank God they've just found another drug and another drug. You see, things are turning around. Things are turning around. Except they found out with all the new pesticides to be certain that we will have more fruit and the farmers can make more money, we find out now they produce 31% less than in 1960. Well, how could that be? How could that be? So they have an answer. They are now going to put in live viruses that will only kill the boll evils and all of those that destroy trees. They will not destroy the tree itself. And they're sure, I'm certain they're sure, because they've got at least 2,000 years of experience of what that new remedy for our, of course, we're not talking about the dangers of the harmful effects and the toxic wastes of all these pesticides. I mean, that was the first reward. But you see, they tell us how pesticides in the beginning were such a wonderful thing. It is a salvation. And we never surrender. We always remain with our consciousness, the brilliant one. And where does it lead us? Into believing people who promise nothing. Yet, when the Torah with the Zohar says, I've created for you here in this life, good and evil, but I've also created for you, a world called Etz HaChayim, where if you can escape, vayanusu, run away, flee from this world, and say to yourself, look, 4% consciousness, and that's all it is. We thank our psychiatrist through many, many years of research and many, many billions and trillions of dollars who have finally come to the conclusion that we really only use between 4 and 6% of our brain. Well, now what about the other 94? Don't worry about it. As long as you got 4%, you'll be all right. That 4% is the evil that we must surrender. But if I surrender my total consciousness and say, I want the consciousness of the light to be my guide. I am a robot, totally. But I can't expect everyone to agree to that, because 4% still makes me feel like I'm in control. Isn't that what consciousness of 4% does? You're always on the plateau of good. But yet the Torah says, no, it's not always going to be good. And then maybe even of us once in a while experience some misfortune. I wouldn't say every day. But some of us sometimes experience misfortune. Here is a world that has no misfortune. Here is a world that doesn't say, I'll give you 364 years, 4 days of misery, and 1 day of happiness. I'll give you 365 days of happiness. But you have to surrender. What are we, a cult over here? Ah. Now we know that the Research Center of Kabbalah is a cult. See? Asking you to surrender your mind. I said surrender your 4% consciousness. Surrender your 4% consciousness. And then, free will says what? What are the stipulations? What are the stipulations? No more thinking? No. The first rule is, know your God. Become educated. Know what the Kabbalah says. You've got to restrict a little. You want to be like the light force of God? You've got to act like the light force of God. Now you're going to be a conscious human being. Because in the 4%, you're totally robotic. But totally robotic. And there you must fall into misfortune as the few in-between moments of happiness. Nothing can we achieve in this world that is lasting, that is full of certainty, that is free of ill health, that is free of financial crisis, except the Etz HaChayim level of reality. And all that you have learned contributes, that education contributes on how you can reach the Tree of Life reality. But the only thing I have always and never spoke about, only until recently, is the idea that we must connect with the consciousness of our 94%, which is really the Etz HaChayim level. So I'm not even asking you to surrender your consciousness, because you'll have to use your consciousness every day of your life to know when you shouldn't steal. You'll have your consciousness there, don't worry. For doing anything negative, you can't surrender your consciousness. You can surrender your consciousness to steal, to eat bad food, how to ruin relationships. That is what the Zohar asks us to surrender. Not such a bad thing in asking us to surrender. But all of the knowledge that we have, Baruch Hashem, disseminated since we opened up the research center to all peoples who just seek the knowledge. But I realize that if we do not ask, forget about thinking of it all the time, but at every moment say, I'm going to do something good and I think it'll work out. Don't say anymore, I won't think. I think it'll work out, or I won't. Then you're back, you know where? To your 4% consciousness that you don't want to surrender. And if you don't surrender it, forget it. Nothing is going to help. Because you don't want to leave go of the tree of knowledge. I'm asking you to leave go. And not anymore say, things are going down. Looks real bad. Stop saying real bad. Is that a surrender? Yes. Surrender to saying things are going bad. Stop with the 4% that tells you constantly how things are bad. And when things happen that don't seem to be something of good fortune, I told you, light, I've been doing everything you asked me, and there you are. The only time a little misfortune can occur is for only one reason. If you want to surrender that and pick up your 4% again, say, see, God, I thought you were here all the time. I asked you to be here all the time. Where are you now? Where are you now when I need you? And God says, I'm testing you.
Alti second. Go back to Alti second.
That's right. In fact, I wasn't sure how I was going to answer that one. Alti tzakalai, don't yell at me. Don't ask me for my help. Well, who else should I ask? Who else should I ask? Go ask your brain. I don't want your brain. Don't yell at me. You can make the miracle happen. But the moment it goes a little different, like the Jew, remember he came to the Red Sea, things were rough. He said, be quiet. Don't put your negativity into it, saying, we're lost. Let's go back to Egypt quickly. We don't want to miss those good restaurants. Then you don't know of the existence of the Etz HaChaim level. Because in the Etz HaChaim level, there could be no misfortune. There can be no mishaps in that level. Run to that level is what we are always being told. Run to it. Run towards it. Run away from the Etz HaDaat level. Run away from the level of the 4% that tells you good and evil, that puts doubts in you. And the reason why is there a reality of Etz HaDaat? Only for the purpose of strengthening and expanding our consciousness, not to reduce our consciousness. When I say surrender, when the Zohar says surrender, the part that belongs to the Satan, the one that we're all aware of is the part that belongs to Satan. He plays with us. He dangles the bait. Makes things look a little good. Well, must have been my brain. And when he sees he's finally caught you in his clutches, he drops you like a hot potato. Then now you don't have the Dark Lord to help you out in your few good moments. And you don't have the Etz HaChaim. You have nothing. You have nothing. Then you go to God and ask him for a miracle. God said, why are you yelling to me? Well, who else should I yell to? But I told you. I told you. You want to be connected with me? Stay with me. But don't run back and say, you know everything. Well, you know nothing. Ask any person, what is tomorrow about? We don't know. If you don't know what tomorrow's about, whatever business you're in, whatever food you're eating, that the scientists have concocted for us, which are probably poisonous down the line. What do we know? Anything about our lives. Anything. People get married. More divorces than marriages. What does that mean? Are we stupid? That's where the Dark Lord has us in control. Can't be stupid.
So what happened when Moses lifted up his hands? Let's go back to that.
Okay. No, it's that I could have answered immediately, but it's like what Kabbalah does for much of the mitzvot and the holidays, where we draw people away from the idea that it's religion. That's what we've been doing until now. It's not religion. It's there for your benefit. It's not so God needs us to say, praise you, God. If God can go ahead and say, that if we do not pray with the names of God, you have not prayed. I said that last time. But now I'm writing it for the first time. I couldn't write it 30 years ago. I would have been stoned. But the Zohar says it. Burn the Zohar. Today it's going to be a little difficult to burn the hundreds of thousands of Zohars all around the world. I mean, how many can they burn in one place? Even Hitler couldn't burn them all. He only burnt in his area. When you say burn books, he hears you. Satan loves it. And when you say throw stones, he loves it. And when you want to bury your fellow Jew by saying nasty and things, even if they're true, but lashon hara, but he hears everything you got to say. Not God, but there's Elohim Achirim. There's another God. He's called the Satan. Also used Elohim Achirim. There's Elohim, the one that belongs to the tree of knowledge. And then there's Elohim Achirim, other gods. What do you mean, other gods? What do you mean, other gods? The Satan. We can even pray with him. We can even murder for the sake of God. For the sake of God. We can give over Jews on false pretenses. This is not the consciousness of Eitz HaChayim. So I'm saying, surrender what? Surrender your consciousness? No, I correct it now. I say surrender your 4%. Because you're going to need your consciousness day in and day out. Day in and day out. That when you say, when you give over a Jew, and I'm going to tell the story which I never dared to say before. It would not be understood. And because more important than just giving you more information. You've got all the information you need, but it's not happening. I don't see it happening. I don't see people telling me every day a miracle happened. Every day I don't hear it. Once in a while they come and tell me a miracle. What happened in between? I don't hear the miracles in between. Why not in between? Because once you've ran away from this level, you ran there. And your ego, which is your 4%, that's all it is, tells you that you're in control, how stupid we are. And I see people haven't lifted their consciousness. They're still operating with all the knowledge they've acquired from Kabbalah with the 4% consciousness. 4%! How could that be? How could that be in the realm of God? How could you even call that a consciousness? We need the 94% consciousness. We know what that is. That's when the Torah says you cannot deliver a person. And it has happened to us. People have delivered us to the police. Even in the case of Buenos Aires that I know you all have heard. Taking three boys of ours who are setting up a center in Buenos Aires, which is going assimilation. There used to be 700,000, now they're down to 300,000. 400,000 have assimilated. So they're doing a crummy job out there, the rabbis. I do a weekly broadcast in Canada. They're calling up and saying, why do I hate the Orthodox Jews? I never mentioned the word Orthodox. I don't mention it here either. I say, if rabbis can take these three boys and tip the police that they blew up the embassy and were arrested by the SWAT team. You know what I mean? When you've got the terrorists there, you know what terrorists are? If you don't walk in with a SWAT team, you know, you yourself are in danger. Walked in with 20 police with machine guns, all ready to be fired, and arrested our three boys, poor them in the morning. This is a story that I never wanted to say. I think the time has come. An iguna is a woman that we don't know if her husband died. It's a Jewish law, and I won't go into the full ramifications of it, but just tell you this is the law. If her husband went out and didn't return, just walked out, we know what happens, never returns again. She cannot remarry. I don't want to go into any particulars or any of the rules and so on, but I'm just saying that's the out-and-out rule. Unless one witness can testify, and that's enough, by the way, that he knows he's dead. In fact, there was a recent case that we were involved with. A man, very religious man, vanished. And took about 6 months, but there was one member of the Jewish mafia who came forward and said that he was there present when they rubbed him out, and he will never be seen again. And on that basis, they gave her permission to marry. I said that for a reason. They came to this rabbi, the Maharshal. If anyone learned Talmud, he would know from the Maharshal. I believe he was the grandfather of the Ari HaKadosh. He's in the back of every section of the Talmud. A woman came and said she's an aguna. What can he do? He immediately wrote a heter iguna. Immediately gave her permission. Immediately. She came with the story, and immediately he wrote her permission to get married. Well, the rabbis raised their arms up in storm. Rabbi, on what basis? Teach us. Maybe we'll learn how to do it. Maybe we wouldn't have to have so many unmarried women whose husbands had disappeared. Now they have every soldier in the Israeli army goes to war like David did. I'd never know why they didn't do that with a prenuptial agreement, which is stupid, but a precondition for a divorce, that if he goes out to the army, no one ever saw him die, shut down in a plane. We still don't know if he died. Anyway, there is an advanced divorce decree granted before the marriage. That's what they do in Israel, so it's not such a terrible situation. Anyway, the rabbi, give us how did you know? You know, her husband he just disappeared. He says, you will know after my death. Okay. He died. And they found an envelope, which said to be read after I die. In that letter he said, this person I know passed over a Jew to the police, and he was executed in prison. I killed that man.
The Marshal killed him?
Yes. He was a great rabbi. What do I mean? The actions of giving over this. I once knew the Brooklyn district attorney. He said, Rabbi, if I would prosecute all the letters I get from Williamsburg, I wouldn't have enough time in the day for 50 years to prosecute all those who are told they cheat on their income tax, they don't pay city taxes, and they do this, and they do that, and do this, and do that. You can't do those things. We can't do those things. We cannot take justice into our own hands, as most times we do. This is a consciousness that we must flee from. This is the evil within us. Yes, that we must flee. If we can flee that, then you are in the level of Etz HaChaim. Then everything you have learned, and I do not say without the knowledge of Kabbalah, can you achieve Etz HaChaim level. No, you cannot. But we can turn things around. I have seen it. With a consciousness to turn things around, which were impossible to turn around. Impossible to turn around. And there are times that I'm not free to discuss this, where a Jew will not even want to turn around because he thinks he can do it. He can't believe in it. It's only God that can do it. And that is wrong, because God said, Matitzak alai. This month is the letter Hey. Well, this month is the letter Hey, and why is it that important? Briefly speaking, you know that Abraham and Sarah's names were changed by the letter Hey. enough to say that the letter hey, and that's why this month is more significant in changing things around. But you must have the consciousness. You must have the knowledge. But without a consciousness or without the knowledge, forget it. You will exist and continue to live in the world of tree and knowledge. And then say, God, where were you when I needed you most? What Moshe wanted to show his about lifting up the hands and down the hands. All the questions I raised make this incident seem stupid. But that wasn't the idea. He's talking about the three-column system. The consciousness of knowing of restriction. The consciousness of knowing how to connect with positive energy. The consciousness of knowing to be positive. The consciousness of when to know that you need. Need is not greed. When need is greed, it's bad. So you've got to be conscious of your left hand too. You have to support yourself. That's why we were brought down here with a body. So we must support ourselves. But does it mean we must support ourselves to the extent of greed? To the extent of stealing? No. So we need a conscience. That's what he was talking about. Right hand of Aaron, left hand of Hur, and Moses was a central column. That's what this was about. But that has to be manifested in a Joshua. You mean God couldn't take care of Amalek? But Amalek means Safek. The uncertainty. It means Satan. That's all it means. You want to know how to wage war against Satan? Safek, which is Amalek. Not a nation. So they defeated him. What happened? And if you read the text, you'll have another 50 more questions you can ask. And I'm not even raising it because of no time. I raised many of them when we had Pasha Zachar. When we came to Pasha Bashalach, we discussed the same numerical value of Amalek is Safek, uncertainty. As long as you keep uncertainty in your mind, that's the first prerequisite. If you keep uncertainty in your mind, you're never going to make it. That's the guarantee of the Torah, not mine, and the guarantee of the Zohar, the way he explains this. To answer the multitude, the infinite number of questions that we can have if you read the Torah clearly. But who listens to the Torah's Parshat HaShavua? Either you're listening to how Jews were, three Russians were killed, and that's the Saturday speech, or the petroleum crisis, or the fall of Russia, or economic things. That's what you hear in a synagogue. Do you walk away with an idea that what this is all about is uncertainty? If you have uncertainty in your head, you'll never make it. And if you do not surrender the 4%, the 4% says uncertainty. Even when it goes a little, not going just like you'd want it. Oh, so where's God? Forget about it. God is there all the time. You know what? Why not even try it? It might even be successful. Maybe. But he's got us so hooked. That's a ton with our consciousness, that ego. I know it all. Who can teach me? And go change? You want to make change? This is the month. That's why this month is so important. Only this month. That's why it's the letter hey. Why the letter hey? Because the hey is the letter that creates changes in our life. But if you don't change your consciousness, meaning, not that you only believe in the hey, that the hey can do this for you, but if you're not praying with the hey this month, forget about it. Go to your other synagogue and find out. I have to speak this way. I see what's going to happen to us. The whole Canadian government can fall. It could be a third world country overnight. Know that. Overnight. It's possible. And the anti-Semites, whom I can do not consider our enemies, will take over overnight. Everywhere. Everywhere. And we'll blame the anti-Semite rather than placing the blame where it belongs. In our consciousness. When Aaron had to be on the right side, if you're a negative person, if you're thinking how to kill the other Jew, and I'm not talking about the Zohar when he says, even when someone has done you wrong, you have revenge. It says in the Torah, no revenge. What do you mean? Do you know what he did to me? But it still says in the Torah, no revenge. Why? Because the moment you think revenge, you think what? Negativity. That's Satan. When the Torah says no revenge, wasn't to make you a pure person and, you know, this is part of our religion. I'll tell you how to keep away from Satan. Every one of those 364 mitzvot, 612 mitzvot, I should say. What did Hillel say? 612 is only about Satan. There's only one mitzvah in the Torah which deals with God and the light. Love your neighbor. It's also one of the mitzvot. And we were in Los Angeles. We walk into this exclusive restaurant. And I want to have a little fun. I say, he said, you know, they always ask a stranger, where do you come from? I says, I come from the New York. He says, oh, what's doing? He says, I don't know. Recently, I just learned that we got to love our neighbor like theirself. He says, you're not Christian, are you? That's what happened. That's one of the precepts in Kedoshim. But according to Hillel, there's only one precept. Only one. The other 612 are telling you either how to strengthen your right hand, because you need positive energy. You've got to be connected with the light force. Light force knows only of positivity. And you avoid uncertainty. But this is the month for it. You do it this month. You'll have it every month of the year. That's what the Torah said. It's the seed. Do the surgery. Not on the month. Do the surgery on yourself. Surrender that 4%. Think only positive. But you've heard that, think only positive, all around a lot. But even when you think it's really almost over, I can tell you from my own experience, but I can tell you what the Zohar says. And for those who haven't tried it yet, think that in any situation, no matter how bad it is, the moment you say, God, where are you? Remember what God told Moses to tell the Jews. Why are you yelling at me? Do something about it. But I can't. I can't. In these times of recession, I have to, you know, constrict. We all have to, what's the word? I just forget me. You know, retrench, but there's a better word for it. What?
Tighten
your belt. No, what?
Consolidate.
Yeah, that's another way, but there's even a better
downside.
One. What?
Downside.
Down?
Downside.
Downside. Think that, and I tell anyone who asks me,
think upside.
The minute you think downside, that's where you're going. That's where you're going. Don't ask me for a bracha. I can't give you a bracha. And that's why it says piason. This was all stipulated already. Why was there a stipulation? Remember I asked that question? Why a stipulation? God could do whatever you want. He wanted to teach you. I injected this. Now it's up to you. God can do the miracle whenever he wants. That's why we needed Joshua. That's why we needed this hand. We need a wind. Because there's a certain time. What's the wind? The east wind. What's east wind? What's the east wind? Restriction.
Restriction.
You learn in Kabbalah. East is, that's why we pray to the east. Okay. We pray to the east if you live here. If you pray in the north, you pray south. Why do we always have to think of east? Why do we think of east? East is restriction. That's where our consciousness does not work. The real 94% to say to yourself, restriction. Someone just slapped you in the face. Think for a minute. Think for a minute. Whether you should slap him back and what do you receive from the slapping back. Oh, you mean he will slap me again?
You deserved it.
But maybe I deserved it. Could it have occurred if it didn't? Did God slap me? Change our consciousness. Now is the time. Now is the month. And we can change everything. But if you're still into the old little trips that we've been in for 2,000 years, I can tell you, 2,000 years says it doesn't work. The Zohar says it doesn't work. We have to surrender again the 4% of our consciousness. That is totally evil. It is totally egotistical. Amen. And a happy holiday to everybody.
So we're going to have a lecture on Pesach when?